Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Misfit Faith podcast. This is episode 13. I'm your host, Jason Stellman. I actually was toying with the idea of doing what a lot of other podcasts do and sort of have seasons, you know, kind of quote-unquote seasons. And I was thinking of doing like 12-episode seasons, which would mean that I would have taken a week off this week instead of just issuing a 13th episode. I would have taken a week off and, you know, worked on other stuff on a Saturday and gone back to doing this next week. But to be honest, I'm like, this is so new that I'm kind of scared that if I take a week off, everyone's going to forget about me and no one's going to come back and listen when I return. So for the time being anyway, I'm just going to do it every week. Eventually, hopefully I'll be comfortable enough to where I'll give myself a break and give all of you a break as well. But we'll see. Our number here is 949-354-2483. If you got a question, something you want to have clarified, if you got some pushback, some feedback on something I've said, then by all means, call, leave me a voicemail, and I'll play it on the air. Real quick, jasonstellman.com is my website, slash mentoring is something I want to bring to your attention. Once we launched the Misfit Faith online community that I've been talking about so much, probably in early spring, I'm going to just have 5 mentoring clients total, okay? And so if you are interested in mentoring, if you're struggling with your spiritual identity, if you're going through some sort of crisis, if you're just trying to figure out what it is you believe and why, one of the things I offer is one-on-one mentoring over the phone, assuming you're not local, for an hour every week, or at least that's what I usually do with clients. And it's been for many people incredibly helpful and even transformative. And so if you are interested in that, don't hesitate. Get on my radar now. Get a time slot now. Go to jasonstellman.com/mentoring and fill out the little form. It's just your name and email. Let me know you're interested, and I will touch base with you, and we can set something up. Another thing I wanted to bring up that I've not talked about before is there is a page on my website for speaking, for booking me to speak. As you all know, I used to be a pastor, and one of the things I really miss, the main thing I really miss about pastoring, is getting the chance to stand in front of people and talk and share and connect in that way. And, you know, it's not something that's easy to do once you're out of the formal ministry. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. If you are a part of a church that is somewhat progressive, or if you're a part of an atheist society or something else, whatever you might be, if there is some sort of event coming up, a conference, a retreat, whatever it might be, hit me up. Let me know if you'd like me to come and speak. I will talk about anything you want. Just give me a ticket and I will be there. My audiobook of Misfit Faith is available on my website, jasonstellman.com/shop. It's the first thing there. It is the deluxe version that will not ever be on Audible. It's just going to be there. And it includes, as I've said before, the entire book, Misfit Faith, Confessions of a Drunk Ex-Pastor, read by me while drinking whiskey and going off on tangents, providing all the original movie quotes and TV quotes that I cite in the book. And so that is available for purchase on the website. You can use a credit card or PayPal. And finally, patreon.com/jasonstellman is the best way to support my work. And so if you can spare $5 a month, you'll have access to my forthcoming devotional called Our Daily Dread. As I write it, as I complete entries, I put them straight up on Patreon. And if you become a patron to the tune of $30, then you get access to the audiobook that way, the Misfit Faith audiobook. All right, moving right along. This past week, I was reflecting a bit on Luke 24. Luke 24 is one of the traditional kind of post-resurrection appearances of Jesus texts in the New Testament, with Easter coming up. I've been kind of thinking about this passage. And in this text, there are two disciples that are walking on this road to Emmaus, and some town that they were walking to. It had been a few days since Christ had died on the cross, and these two disciples were super bummed out, and they're walking along, just all downtrodden. And who meets them on the road and joins their walk but Jesus himself? Although, according to the text, the disciples' eyes are in some way supernaturally prohibited from recognizing him. They can't see that it's him. And, you know, they're just kind of moaning and complaining, and Jesus says, "What's the problem?" And they say, "What are you, new in town? This Jesus of Nazareth guy that we had hoped was the, you know, savior of Israel, the hope of Israel, he was crucified a few days ago, and, you know, all of our hopes are dashed." And so Jesus says to them, "O fools and slow of heart to believe all that the scriptures have said, ought not the Christ to have suffered these things before entering into his glory?" And he begins in the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures and begins to expound to them all the things concerning himself. A pretty familiar passage, especially among evangelicals. But, you know, for me, thinking about this passage, the most interesting part is often overlooked. I mean, usually people appeal to this verse, these sets of verses, as, you know, proof that the Old Testament prophesied about Christ or whatever. But for me, the most head-scratching part of it is found a little bit later. As the three men arrive at their destination, they all go into a house, and they're going to have a meal. And it's at this point that Jesus, sort of as the host, takes bread and breaks it and blesses it and distributes it to them. And it's at this moment, as they see him bless and break the bread, that their eyes are opened and they recognize that it's him. And then it says he disappears. Not in the sense of just he kind of ghosts out of there or whatever, but he literally vanishes before their eyes. Now, that part to me, and also what they say a little bit later, is the most head-scratching part of this entire account. Because you see, Jesus, you know, having, so the story goes, risen from the dead, you'd think that this would be the time to kind of seize the moment. You know, I mean, it's like, what better time to, like, capitalize on your fame and notoriety than, you know, right after you've risen from the dead, right? And so you'd think what he would have done is kind of seize the moment, muster his forces, and just launch some sort of hostile takeover of the corrupt religious and political establishment of his day, right? That's what a lot of his disciples wanted him to do anyway, to kind of storm the gates of Rome and say there's a new boss in town, right? But instead of seizing the moment, as we would have thought he would have done, he just kind of disappears. He pieces out of there completely and misses what seems to be an incredible opportunity to seize power. But then it gets even more intriguing if you keep reading. I would argue that in this episode we see sort of a hint at what the Christian life looks like on this side of the cross and empty tomb. And it's the furthest thing from what most believers expect. Often Christians desire a kind of, you know, personal, unmediated, face-to-face, kind of direct hotline to heaven style relationship with Jesus. You know, when I was coming up, you know, in evangelicalism, it was all about this. It was all about, you know, Christ is your best friend and God is right there with you. And you tell him all of your problems and he's just there, a present help in time of trouble to answer, you know, to be there at your beck and call whenever you ring your little bell. There he is. And yet, in this account, we see something very different. Whether it's better or worse than what we're taught to expect is, you know, not for me to say. But you see, in place of this kind of triumphalistic, high-octane, face-to-face form of spirituality that many Christian churches and leaders promise, what Luke sets forth here is a form of life according to which, as it says in verse 35 of that chapter, Jesus is made known in the breaking of the bread. This is what happens. You know, the disciples, as I said, see him bless and break the bread, which of course harkens them back to the upper room and the Last Supper and all that stuff. They see him break the bread. They realize it's him. He vanishes. Then they run off and find more disciples and explain to them that Christ appeared to them and, quote, was made known to us in the breaking of the bread. In other words, the manner by which God is to be found is not flashy but mundane. And think about it. I mean, what could be more mundane than bread? It's like literally the most boring thing ever. Now, many Christians don't want to hear this. Many Christians don't want to hear that the spiritual life is not what they've come to expect it to be, you know, a series of mountaintop experiences, one after the other, each one, more impressive than the last, each one more kind of goosebumpy than the one before it. That's what we want. And oftentimes, especially evangelicalism is so event driven, you know, it's all about the next big event, the next concert, the next retreat, the next summer camp, whatever it might be. And, you know, we're sort of taught to expect the spiritual life to be this kind of thing. But according to this passage, which arguably is one of the very first illustrations of what the spiritual life looks like on this side of the empty tomb, it doesn't look like that at all. You know, as long as we're gazing up to heaven, longing for God to speak to us or to show us a sign or to reveal his will or whatever, we'll continue to miss the opportunities that present themselves all around us every day to be Christ to the downtrodden, the marginalized, and the poor of the earth. You know, in the Eucharist, which is what the church traditionally has called the Last Supper, we learn, and not just learn, but in some sense enact, the process by which God is present to the world. You know, as an aside, there's a sense in which more ancient traditions, you know, let's say it's Eastern Orthodoxy or Catholicism or certain forms of high church Protestantism that are more ritualistic. In a sense, those traditions do, in fact, properly manage our expectations, right? Because the spiritual life in those traditions, and I would also argue in Judaism as well, and Islam, by the way, those traditions sort of set forth a set of things that you do, a certain rituals that you do by rote, you know, whether it's keeping a kosher home or facing the east three times a day to pray or breaking bread and drinking wine on the first day of the week, whatever it might be. In those kinds of contexts, our expectations are managed and our understanding of the spiritual life is much more simple and much more earthy, as opposed to the kind of high-octane evangelicalism that I've been describing. But as I was saying, in the Eucharist, we enact this process by which God is present to the world. We take the bread, which is Jesus, and we consume it, assimilating him into our very bodies, and then we go and be the body of Christ to those around us. Because for them, the only icon or sacrament of the divine they may ever encounter is us. And so the sooner we put out of our minds this idea that the Christian life is about one big fireworks display after another, and train ourselves to see God in the mundane, common, natural things, the things of this earth, the sooner we're able to see it that way, I think the less we're going to miss the opportunities that present themselves right in front of our very eyes each and every day to display the gospel by dignifying and humanizing the other. Now, about a year or so ago, when I was doing a bunch of promo interviews and stuff for my forthcoming book, I was interviewed by three guys who do a podcast called Inglorious Pastards. And one of the three is Matt Pauley. He's a great guy. He understands what the spiritual life is about and understands the connections between earth and heaven, between the human and the divine, between grace and nature. And Matt graciously agreed to chat with us for a few moments about this very topic. And so I'm going to get on the horn, see if I can get Matt on the phone. Hang on.
Hello.
Hey, I'm looking for Matt Pauly. Is he there?
He is here, right here with you.
Hey, man, I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule to chat with us.
I'm glad to. I'm glad to talk to you again.
Yeah, so we have been talking on this episode kind of about the Christian life and about, at least in my experience, when I was in evangelicalism, everything was kind of about kind of high octane, unmediated, direct communication with Jesus, sort of mountaintop summer camp type of spirituality. And I'm curious, you know, tell us a bit about your story. You know, was your life, your Christian life at some point characterized by that kind of desire for that type of mountaintop experience of God? And how did that work for you?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, most of evangelicalism was like that and probably still is. Yeah, when I grew up, the big thing, especially in high school, were they were Christ in Youth conferences. You know, they were summer camps on steroids held at college campuses. And it was mostly, again, that, like you said, that high octane, loud worship music, very emotionally driven. And I would even say emotionally manipulative. You know, I remember one particular junior high conference when I was a youth minister taking kids to, and they showed scenes from The Prince of Egypt, the Disney version of Prince of Egypt. And then they showed, intermixed it with scenes from, I think, Stigmata, where they pound the nails into the guy's wrists. You know, the idea of being very much to manipulate these kids' emotions. And all of my high school was like that. I committed my life to ministry in high school. At one of these conferences, I saw numerous friends go forward to rededicate their life for the fifth time. And, you know, kids going forward to be baptized that, you know, later on never really went anywhere for them. So in one sense, it worked in that you came back, you know, higher than a kite on Jesus. The problem was, I can remember one instance where I came back from a conference and I had Van Halen's 1984 waiting on my bed I'd ordered from Columbia House. And I felt completely grief stricken by that for some reason, because I, you know, I had an angel smoking a cigarette on the cover. And I felt like I'd let Jesus down after this big, huge, massive mountaintop experience. So it was just really hard to maintain. And I would say impossible to maintain that high when you have to go back to normal life.
Yeah, dude, I just got to ask you this. Was your copy of 1984, was it a CD? Because I had it on cassette, dude.
I had it on CD. I was into CDs at that point. So I owned Bon Jovi Slippery When Wet on cassette. I do remember that.
Yeah, I remember that. The cover of the 1984 was like the angel was like a little kid,
yes,
and like a little toddler. And he had angel wings and he had a cigarette in his hand. It was pretty scandalous at the time, huh?
Well, for a 17-year-old evangelical who just dedicated his life to ministry, it was devastating. I think I actually remember crying in my car over to my on my way to my grandparents' house for something because I felt so grief-stricken by it.
I remember we used to go when I was a part of the Baptist church in Orange County where I grew up. We used to go to Hume Lake every summer, which was this massive Christian summer camp that all these different youth groups would join. There'd be hundreds of kids. And every year on the bus ride home, because it was probably like a 3-4 hour bus ride, we'd all be kind of destroying our secular music and, you know, making all these promises to Jesus, which of course, you know, once you get back down the mountain, the dust settles, you go back and you buy all that stuff again, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember in college, I destroyed ZZ Top's Greatest Hits for some reason and two Aerosmith CDs, which I'm not sure was really that much of a loss, but for whatever reason, those are the ones I chose that the devil was teaching me things through, I guess. I don't really know what happened, but it was you know, we called them morality attacks in college, where we had a friend who was famous for it. He would get rid of all of his movies. And so we would just take his movies he was getting rid of because he felt bad. But that, again, it's that you come back to this real world and you're trying to find some way to sustain that high. So you break CDs and you get rid of music. You start reading, you know, all these Christian books and buying Christian albums and trying to maintain and sustain that high, which is really just not even sustainable.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I mean, I'm curious, you know, you've kind of touched upon, I was going to ask you what the dangers of this sort of spirituality are, and you've touched on it a little bit already. You know, from my experience and from my memory, part of the problem is that, you know, you can't just go from one mountaintop experience to another that's of the same level. You've always got to ratchet it up. You've always got to top the experience from last time. And so one of the dangers, it seems to me, is never really, I mean, it's like if you're addicted to drugs, you need something, you need a higher high, you need a more potent drug. And it seems like when you apply that to spirituality, it just makes it completely unsustainable. But I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you said it's a drug. That's absolutely what it is. And I'm guessing if they did brain scans of people at these conferences, you would find the same kind of thing as when somebody takes a hit of heroin. I mean, I'm guessing it activates the same pleasure centers. And so when you do that, you again and again and again have to keep feeding that thing, or you have no way of even living in any kind of normal reality, because to you, that's such a great thing. You want that to be the reality, and not realizing the danger is that that is not reality at all. Like that is a 1 week occurrence out of 52 weeks in a year. And so you've got to find a way to live in the other 51 weeks a year without that high. And nobody teaches how to do that. I remember when I was in youth minister taking kids these conferences and trying to warn them, look, you know, by this point I understood what these things were doing. It's like, look, you're going to be higher in a kite when you come back from this, but that is not where life is meant to be lived. And the danger is that no one's teaching people, these students or adults or whoever it is, how to live life in the midst of the absolute mundane day to day, get up, take your shower, go to work, feed the kids, put them to bed, come, you know, that kind of stuff. Nobody's teaching people how to find God in the midst of all of that.
Yeah. You know, I've always said, you know, evangelicalism is, you know, at least my experience of it is it's very event driven. Like you were saying, you know, it's the next concert, the next retreat or conference or summer camp or whatever. And I found, you know, as I ventured out of that into both old school Presbyterianism and Catholicism, that there's something comforting and healthy about more kind of mundane and routine expressions of the faith that emphasize things like, you know, weekly church attendance and just the kind of the boring stuff. But there's something powerful about being trained to be okay with the sort of rote and routine things of life, because that's what life really is like, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm married with two kids, and it's like literally just a routine day in and day out. And even now at 41, I still find it difficult to find God in the midst of those moments. There are people now who are doing work, you know, Richard Rohr being one of them, who are more helping people try to identify those moments and be conscious of those moments and live in those moments of the mundane drive. I mean, I drive 1500, 1800 miles a week for work. Like, I have a lot of downtime, a lot of time to think and be bored. And so I can either find God in those moments, or I can just literally just drive and be bored and just listen to podcasts and listen to music and never really experience God or even be open to experiencing God in different ways.
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about in this episode is the fact that in the post-resurrection appearance of Christ in Luke 24, I think it is, where he meets the disciples on the road to Emmaus, yeah. The way that they describe the encounter, because you know they don't realize it's him until he breaks bread and distributes it, and then they recognize him, and then he literally just straight up vanishes, like he disappears. And then when they describe it later to the other disciples, they say that he was made known to us in the breaking of the bread. And I think that there's something deeper there about the sort of sacramental nature of the way God is met by man, especially this side of the incarnation story. You know, nothing's more mundane than bread. It's like literally the most boring thing ever. But that is the way that, you know, that we encounter God now, among other ways. So I was going to ask you, you know, how do you, other than, you know, you drive a lot, you said, and you have a lot of time to think, and you know, amen about Richard Rohr. I'm taking one of my mentoring clients through Falling Upward, and it's great. But like, you know, what kind of everyday mundane ways do you kind of do spirituality now? I know you're a pipe smoker. I think you like scotch, right? A lot of people I know kind of find God in some way in the ritual of those kinds of things. But I'm curious if you could just talk a bit about the more mundane ways that you kind of feel like you connect with God now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm definitely a scotch drinker and definitely a pipe smoker and the occasional cigar. And I definitely find God in those moments because they force me to slow down. If anybody's ever smoked a pipe or cigar, it's kind of a commitment, especially a cigar. I mean, you're committed for an hour. So, and the same thing with a glass of scotch, you don't just pound a glass of good scotch. You take time with it, you sip it, you savor it, you know, you pick the flavors out of it, you just really enjoy it. And so those things force you to not only physically slow down and sit and enjoy those things, but they force you to mentally slow down as well so that you can take those things in and enjoy them as they are. When the weather gets anywhere above about 60 or 65 degrees here in Indiana, I am probably to be found out in my driveway with a book, with a glass of scotch or a beer, possibly a pipe, just reading and enjoying my quiet neighborhood. I live on a dead end street, so there's never traffic, and just sitting and enjoying the time. Even if the weather's crap, I'll sit in my garage and just be out there alone. Particularly if nobody's home, I'll just sit out there alone and do those things. And I find that everything slows down for me. And I think that it's in those moments where the story in scripture of Elijah, you know, hiding in the mount in the caves, and he asked God to show him something. God shows up and he shows there's fire and there's wind, there's an earthquake, and God wasn't in any of those things, but he was in the still small voice. And I think there's something very, very truthful about that's how God operates. That, you know, you have these big loud moments, these conferences and things like that. And I'm not saying that God doesn't show up in those things, but the other 51 weeks out of the year, God is going to be in that still small voice. He's going to be in that glass of scotch. He's going to be in that driveway with you with that book. He's going to be in that time where you're literally just staring out into your neighborhood and just your mind is blank. And you're just enjoying the idea of just being a human being and just being alive and being present and being in that one single moment. I've told my oldest, I have a 15-year-old son. I've told him several times that we're literally guaranteed nothing outside of the current moment. Like there's no guarantee, you know, an asteroid could land on my house or something. Like I'm not guaranteed any moment but the one I'm in right now. And so you have to take that moment for whatever it is. And that's also when things go to crap also, because, you know, Rohr talks about one of the great teachers is suffering, and suffering is one of the things where we learn the most about who we are, and we come to have to rely on God even more than we already do. And so whether things are good, things are mundane, or things are just in the toilet, God is to be found in those things. If we are willing to slow ourselves down and be just in that moment and see what that moment has to teach us, or what that moment has to do to comfort us, or what that moment has to show us as far as joy. It's all about being completely in that moment at that specific time, and not looking to the future with anxiety, not looking to the past with regret, but just where you are right now.
Yeah, man. I was thinking about just yesterday, I was writing something about the sheep and the goats judgment, you know, in Matthew 25, where Jesus says to the sheep, you know, to the he gathers the nations, you know, like a shepherd separates his sheep from the goats. And he says to those on his right, you know, come into the kingdom because you clothed me when I was naked. You fed me when I was hungry. You cared for me when I was in need. And their response was when, you know, when did we do that? You know, and it kind of struck me that there's a blessedness to their obliviousness, you know, because they weren't keeping a tally of all the amazing things they did, all the feats and exploits that they accomplished. Because sometimes I think we look at, you know, the spiritual life or life in general as something heroic is going to define me. I'm going to pull a body out of a burning building, you know? But most of us never get that opportunity to pull a body out of a burning building. And instead, we just have the people right in front of us, the needs that present themselves, the kids that we raise, whatever relationship we're in. And often it's very unnoteworthy. It's very boring. It's very mundane. But that's kind of what faithfulness, I think, looks like, is it's faithfulness in the midst of the everyday rather than waiting for that one heroic action that we can perform, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I guess the ultimate goal of being a Christ follower or fully human, whatever term you want to use, is that you literally just do things without even considering why you're doing them. You literally are just, you go and you work at the homeless shelter because it's the human thing to do. You go and you work at an LGBTQ shelter for teens who have been kicked out of their home. You do it because it's just who you've become. You do all, whatever the thing is, whatever mission work it is, or whatever term you want to use for it, you do those things because you simply become the kind of human being that it becomes automatic for to do that. You see a need, you meet the need, whatever that need may be, no matter how big or how small it may be. And you don't do it for reward, and you don't do it for storing up your treasure in heaven or whatever. You do it simply because there's a need that a fellow human being has. And so you meet that need.
Well, Matt, as we finish up, tell us what you're doing. I mean, where can my audience find you and your various projects that you're working on? Tell us about your podcast, and tell us kind of where people can connect with you guys on social media.
Yeah, the podcast is called Inglorious Pastards. You can find it anywhere you find podcasts. We're on Stitcher, we're on Apple, we're everywhere. It's a podcast with, we talk about spirituality, we talk about current events, we talk about news, we talk about, we tell dirty jokes, it's a little bit of everything. It's not your mother's podcast, I will say that, and we are explicit, so just fair warning to your listeners. You can find us on Twitter at Pastards Podcast, podcast, that's PASTERDS. At Pastors Podcast on Twitter, Facebook. I think it's Inglorious Pastards. We have a website, ingloriouspastors.com. You can find me at Polly Named Matt on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. We're on Instagram. We're pretty much anywhere you can find us. Just search for us and you'll come across us at some point.
Well, Matt, dude, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today. I really like your perspective, and I think our audience is going to resonate with the stuff you had to say. So thanks very much, man.
You're welcome. I'm glad to do it.
Hi, Jason. This is Josh from Pittsburgh. I thought I'd call in after listening to your last episode of Misfit Faith. I was listening through the entire thing, and I kept thinking to myself, I wonder if Jason's ever looked into processed thought from Whitehead and Griffin. So I wanted to, you know, mention it to you that maybe you want to look into some processed thought, maybe with Bruce Epperly's book on The Answer to Processed Faith, or something like that. I don't know if that's the right title, but process deals a lot with how we've created ourselves a coercive and controlling God, and how the Bible more describes through the story of Jesus a persuasive and relational God, and how God works and lives within people and life and does not control and coerce the world towards a certain end, but instead persuades and pulls in a relational way the world and life towards a kingdom future. So yeah, I thought I'd mention and call in and let you know that I was thinking through processed faith the whole time. And I hope that you can look into it if you haven't already. And I love your show, so I'll listen to you all next week, and take care.
All right. Thanks, Josh, for the question. To be honest, I'm not super familiar with process thought or process theology. But insofar as I do understand it, and insofar as I am kind of somewhat familiar with it, I do appreciate at least this much, the pushback against the idea of an impassible and immutable God. And I'll define those terms. You know, traditionally, and some would argue that the Christian tradition is overly influenced by a kind of Hellenistic, you know, Greek philosophy or whatever. The traditional view sort of depicts God as sitting above the fray. You know, he's impassible, which means he doesn't feel anything. He doesn't suffer, right? And he's immutable, meaning he doesn't change, right? He's eternal and always the same. And this kind of understanding of God as being static, you know, sitting above the fray of this world in a, you know, in such a transcendent, detached manner, he almost seems to not really give a toss what happens, right? And not only is this hard to square with a lot of, you know, the actual accounts in Scripture where God is mad or God is bummed out or God is happy or whatever, you know, in many ways, God seems to be responding to events as they transpire on the earth as they happen. And of course, the traditional understanding of those accounts is that, well, you know, this is just kind of anthropomorphic examples of making God seem like a human in order so that we can relate to him or we can understand him. But nevertheless, this is the traditional view. You know, he foreordained all things either by decree or permission, right? So he either actively predestined everything to happen or he passively permitted it to happen, right? Knowing it would and not stopping it. Meaning that, you know, everything that transpires, even evil, is in some sense his will. And of course, you know, Calvinists and especially hyper-Calvinists have no problem with this. They just bite that bullet like it's nothing, right? But what process thought, process theology, and other non-traditional options do is they make God more imminent and involved, you know, as though he's a co-sufferer participating in our world alongside us. And, you know, that to me is, at least at my current level of familiarity with process theology, that is my takeaway, and that is what I do actually appreciate about it. You know, and I would even say, let's do a thought experiment. Let's get a little radical here and ask, you know, the question, what if we went even further than this? You know, what if we postulated a God who identifies with this world even to the point of emptying himself into it and pouring himself out upon it? I mean, what if God identifies with the world to the point that heaven is now empty of him? You know, I mean, could this be what the incarnation is really about? God coming down to earth, not just in the sense of being aware or involved or predestining everything, but in the form of a man, Jesus, who is himself the prototype of a new kind of human. Could this be what the day of Pentecost is all about? God pouring his spirit out upon all flesh so that we all now are both, in some sense, human and divine. We're both nature and grace. Just a couple thoughts, Josh. I realize I didn't go probably as deeply as you would have wanted me to do, but nevertheless, there you go. Time's almost up, but you know what? I need a minute.
Now it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
Now, like anyone, I have a complicated relationship with nuts. Now, let me explain. The only nut I despise is the walnut, even though every time I ask someone whether this has walnuts in it, I get taken way too seriously, you know, like I've got some deadly allergy or something. No, I just hate the taste of walnuts. And, you know, for what it's worth, kind of as an aside, when people are making some dish or a dessert for a bunch of people, like for a dinner party or a church function or whatever, they should leave out the fringy, controversial parts that aren't universal safe bets, right? Like walnuts in brownies or mushrooms in some sort of pasta or casserole. You know, like if you're cooking for a whole bunch of people, don't put that in there because it's not like, you know, universally known that everyone likes this. But I'm not here to talk about mushrooms, not here to talk about walnuts. I'm here to talk about peanuts in the shell. Now, this is my favorite way to eat peanuts. I love peanuts in the shell. But here's the problem. The problem is the mess. You know, sometimes when you take a peanut and you got it in your hand and the seam is just right, and using the soft touch and coordination of an eye surgeon, I can crack that thing and extract the nut with minimal fallout. But most of the time, the damn thing just explodes, and it's like a hailstorm of shell shards and nut dust, and my clothes look like it's frickin' 9/11, and I'm standing at the foot of the South Tower. Now, I can't afford a damn hazmat suit, okay? So, science, hey, if you could like put aside your obsession with global warming and come up with a way that I can eat some peanuts without afterwards needing to burn my clothes and vacuum my desk of the inch-thick film of what looks like volcanic ash covering it, that'd be great, okay?
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, to play us out of the show, this is one of the coolest groups out there. They're called Handsome Boy Modeling School, and it's this just great kind of combination of old school jazz and hip hop that I think is really cool. So this is a song called The Truth by Handsome Boy Modeling School. See you later. Peace. You wear a thin disguise. It's from yourself you hide. Take a look at us, so we are heading for a fall.
Now presiding in this court of hip-hop justice, my rap forte is judge, jury, bailiff, and prosecuting DA, cassettarist, paraphrase, my modus operandi is carpe diem, whether de facto or de jure, comprende the people versus, you ain't a sensei teaching that style of wordplay week of the Wednesday, regardless of what your friends say, they're all disabled, stricken from the record, indeed.